Welcome to Magic in the Moment, mindfulness in real time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath. Just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment and doing this intentionally can create that same magic. And our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. This episode is sponsored by Meditation for Leadership, bringing the power of mindfulness to leaders and teams. Clearer thinking, stronger connections, and better decision-making can start with just a few moments of mindfulness meditation. Meditation for Leadership offers live, interactive training programs that blend neuroscience and practical techniques to build resilience, emotional intelligence, and focus, so you can lead with confidence and clarity. Experience the difference mindful leadership makes. Visit meditationforleadership.org to learn more. I'm very pleased to have as my guest today, Ara Tucker. Ara, who is a storyteller, she is a human-centered leader and coach and author. And we will be touching on a lot of, I think, interesting and fun things, but the importance that I want you to kind of keep your ear and eye tuned to are looking at presence in the moment, personal awareness, dipping into curiosity, looking at things with a child's eye, the importance of the journey, and where storytelling becomes such an integral part of Ara's life, and I think becomes, I think in many respects, a model of how we can improve the way we look at things and share and communicate with others. And finally, a little bit of wisdom that Ara's mother shared that I'd love to close the program with. But Ara, I'm reminded, first of all, so pleased that you could be with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, and when we first talked a few weeks ago, you reminded me of a story that took place when you were, I guess, a first-year law student at NYU, and just happened to be in September of 2001, and in the midst of what was happening on a beautiful but troubled day in Lower Manhattan, some very interesting things unfolded in the midst of what I imagine was just a jumble of emotions. But in the midst of all that, the ability to recognize in your memories the vivid picture of this yellow flower in a restaurant that helped you bring to mind how you were in that moment and how important being present in that moment was. Can you run us through that story again?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, again, I think this is such an important topic, this idea of how to stay present, how to stay grounded and centered in a world that's continuously uncertain and uncertain and shaky. So for me, that day in September is one that it's really hard to imagine. And yet there are things, as you mentioned, that are so crystal clear. You know, one is just the sound of a door slamming. You know, when you think about anxiety, you're always like, what can I see? What can I hear? What can I feel? What can I smell? This idea of getting in touch with senses. And hearing that door slam was sort of the first moment, the memory that I still have of that day of my roommate running out of our apartment and downstairs. And I didn't really understand what was going on. You know, we were friendly, but not friends. And I couldn't imagine what could be so dramatic that she'd have to slam a door. But I went downstairs and I saw people milling about. That was sort of another clue that this wasn't going to be any other, you know, ordinary day. And there was talk about a plane hitting a building. It was very unclear the magnitude. Of course, we all know now how horrible and horrific it was. But at the time, it was really spotty what was going on. And I remember my roommate really being concerned because her father worked downtown, even farther downtown than we were. And there were reports of really, really awful things happening. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like forever, but I'm sure it was just moments where, you know, a man in a soot-stained suit walked into the courtyard, And my roommate ran to him, and I was like, oh my gosh, she was worried about her father. That's what she was running out of our apartment so frantic about. And then another father, it was my father, and he happened to be in town. And upon hearing the news, kind of, I guess, came down to see, make sure I was okay. And, you know, he spotted me, he knew I was okay. And he and my roommate's father looked at each other, and they embraced. And to me, seeing that scene, two strangers, two grown men, one, you know, soot stained, one, you know, pretty remarkably clean and polished, you know, just in that moment being so human. It's not something that I will soon forget. And then the strangest thing of all, you know, that ordinary impulse of let's go eat. You know, my father said, are you hungry? And I strangely was. And so we walked to one of our favorite shared restaurants that's no longer there, but it was called Bar 89. And I remember a bud vase with a yellow flower. And I don't know what we ate. I don't know what we talked about, but I remember that flower. And it's one of the memories that I still have even after, you know, understanding the magnitude of the sheer horror, the sheer fear, the loss, the incalculable tragedy. And yet my brain, you know, continues to bring back that memory for me. Mm.
Yeah, I have that image of the flower and sort of representing in some respects the tenderness of being with your father during those moments. To me, there's a huge sort of underscore of your being present then, and he really being present for you. And sometimes that some simplicity of let's go eat. I love, you know, it's like of all the things that you needed to be together, and there was a space that was, you know, in some respects reflected, I guess, some safety and good feeling for both of you. Yeah. So Ara, I'm reminded that our being introduced to each other really came as sort of interest to me. It's what's fascinating about it is that we share an alma mater, but our connection actually came through this person who's very special to me, and I think has been special to you throughout your sort of professional life. And this is Steve Cohen, who's a senior managing partner at Morgan Lewis. And in my life, his importance is that he's the founder, co-founder, and board chair of Meditation for Leadership, for whom I have been connected for about 4 years, and just do work with. And it's very important to me and dear to my heart. You began your professional career working for the firm where Steve was a partner. And I think you had told me earlier about sort of the transition after law school to that firm and then the decision about whether to stay or move on. And again, I think that underscores in many respects the importance of how we work through decisions like that and finding the truth and the realities. And that to me is being present.
Yeah. You know, thinking about how I found my way to Morgan Lewis, on some level, it actually goes back to that 9/11 story. A little bit of a reaction, you know, once the lunch was over, once all of the things, I didn't realize it, but I was pretty scared being in New York City. And I did summer at a firm after my first summer. And I just think that I started to imagine Princeton as a place of safety. As you mentioned, we share an alma mater. I went to Princeton University. Whether it was 9/11 or the blackout, we had a blackout too while I was in law school, these ideas of sort of being in this bustling metropolis and yet assuming that if I could just get out of it and get across the river to Princeton, I grew up in New Jersey, so maybe that's part of it, home, everything would be okay. And I think that thinking about where I was going to practice law, I had always assumed, you know, I went to a New York law school, I went to NYU. I think I was like, I'm going to be a New York lawyer. You know, that's kind of what you do. Mm. And I just, after that, I realized I gotta try something else because this is not quite settling for me. This is pretty unnerving. And so long story short, I ended up at Morgan Lewis, first in the Philadelphia office, and then got even closer to the Princeton and the Princeton office. And I think that I assumed I would be there for a while. You know, when you start out practicing law, you think, okay, you sort of stay until you're a mid-year, and then you decide, do I go in-house? Do I try to make partner? And I think for me, I just, that process got sped up. Again, out of a reaction, right? I would love to say everything I've done has been proactive, but a lot of the things I've done in my life that have worked out have been reactions to things. And this was my girlfriend at the time going to business school. Mm. She got into Stanford and it was wonderful and amazing. And I was very happy for her. And I also realized that even though we were, you know, almost 7 years into a relationship, that I did not want to take the California bar. So that said a few things to me. That said, one, maybe you don't want to be a lawyer, right? And two, maybe there's something else for you to do, right? Something else to make use of yourself and to be of service. And so she was an admission officer, again, not so creative, but I said, maybe I could do something at a university. You look like you're having fun. You're around smart people, and started talking to folks who were lawyers, but not practicing at firms. Ended up at Princeton in the provost's office and the executive vice president's office, not practicing law, just learning what it meant to be a central administrator at a great school. And I remember going to tell Steve that I was leaving. And I remember he said something like, aren't you going to be bored? And with, you know, with Steve, that was another sort of, for me, affirmation that I was doing the right thing, even though it felt silly and scary at the same time. Because he loves what he does, you know, he loves being an attorney. He loves, and I just saw that light and him and my parents. And I just said, you've got to go find that light, Ara. It's not here. You've done all of this work. Use the work, take it somewhere else and keep trying. And so I've been sort of on a career journey that hasn't really matched anyone else's that I've met so far, but it's mine. And, you know, I've been very grateful to be able to have it.
I so appreciate that. As someone who's had a career journey that is not like anybody else's either, I think the importance of asking yourself those questions, I think rethinking, it makes me think of Adam Grant's book, right? Just challenging what the expectations were. And it's like, why did I make this decision? And it doesn't mean the decision when you made it to go to law school or go to work at a major law firm was wrong, but it doesn't mean that that answer is still correct going forward. And I think that's a huge part of our taking that moment to challenge the status quo and to ask ourselves, how is this moment different from when these original decisions were made? So that makes so much sense to me. At the same time, I recognize that what causes us to rethink those decisions can seem in retrospect to be, it's about a girlfriend, boyfriend, partner, whatever. And yet, whatever that stimulus is, it did cause you to pause. And that pause is like where the power is, right? Yeah. So true. So true. So then one of the things that I really loved when we were talking before, I thought it was such an interesting story. You were talking about going and meeting with your boss, right? So When you go to meet with your boss, you see the receptionist who happens to be a classmate of yours, and your interactions with your classmate are on a pretty professional level. So take me through that and sort of what you learned through that process and what the results were from that.
Yeah. So to understand my interactions with my former classmate / receptionist, there's a story. My seventh grade tennis coach used to tell my parents. He said, I don't know if she's winning out there or losing. She's kind of always the same person. And I actually, you know, until somebody said that, I actually hadn't thought about that. And I carried that with me into my interview with my boss at Princeton. And you talk about reading the room, right? Sometimes you have to read the person in front of you. And I noticed that she was someone who was highly expressive, highly emotional, highly excited, right? Like, I'm so excited to tell you about this opportunity and it's going to be, and I just knew that that era, you know, on the tennis court, like, okay, I'm doing this thing, I'm focused, but like, I'm like this. And I remember saying to her in that moment, I am really excited about this opportunity. And it may not seem like that. I can sense that you're someone who's really great at emoting. I do not always show up the way that I am feeling. I am not always expressing it outwardly. So even in that interview, I knew I had to sort of reset expectations. However, when I got the job, right, and I would walk in to meet with my boss, I was kind of like, okay, I've got a meeting. I'm on time. Is she ready? Does she need me to wait? Like, that was my modus operandi. I wasn't thinking anything else. I was very pleasant. I wasn't rude, but I wasn't interested in like, let's have some small talk. Let's talk about the weekend. Let's like, how are you doing? Da, da, da. Didn't think anything of it. We were in a team offsite, you know, provost office, and we did, it's called social styles, I think, one of these assessments, right, about how do you show up in relation to others. And I remember I was out on this quadrant called analytical, and my classmate was somewhere, I think, emotive, expressive, something like that. But we were kind of like as opposite as you can get. And in true sort of opposite fashion, you know, I'm sort of taking this in quietly. She blurts out, oh, Ara, this makes so much sense. Now I get it. I just thought all this time you didn't like me. And oh my gosh, Clayton, I mean, gutted is a little dramatic, but like, I had never meant to make anyone feel like I, you know, had anything but, you know, most respect and civility, right? And to hear somebody feel that the way I was constantly showing up was sort of showing a lack of regard or something unfriendly, it made me think. And so even today as a manager, I'm really focused on like, what does each direct report need? Like, how do we actually like enter our space together? Do we want to talk about TV? Do we want to talk about the weekend? And actually, like, as I've gotten more senior, I'm realizing like, it's actually really helpful for me too. You know, sometimes the agenda is not what's on the sort of to-do list. Sometimes it's actually, how do I build trust? How do I build a relationship? How do I get to know you? So again, you know, it's one of these like pause, but also reflect and adapt and adjust.
I'm thinking about that, and I think that aha, right? For both of you, right? She goes, oh, I thought you just didn't like me, right? And you're thinking, why would she think that? Oh, because this is how I come across, right? And those two different social styles learning to coexist and then to try to modulate so that you can have a more sort of common sense of communication. I'm going to share, if you don't mind, because it just fits into this. My first job out of college, I worked for Bankers Trust in Employee Benefit Trust Administration. Now, anybody who knows Clayton Platt would hear that and they go, how did you possibly exist in a job that sounds so mundane? And it was. That being said, when I first started, I would show up every day being the ebullient Clayton who felt like I need to let people know that I'm happy and life is good. But 2 weeks into the job, nobody was talking to me. And I went to my training director and I said, Vinny, no one seems to like me. And he said, no one trusts you. I said, what do you mean? He says, nobody trusts that any human being could show up every day and be so happy. And I said, well, I'm actually not happy. I'm terrified. And he said, let them know.
Yeah.
Right. So in my case, I had the sense that I needed to be ebullient and happy and gregarious, because that is a large part of my personality, but it wasn't what people needed to know to connect with me. So I appreciate hearing your story about, for example, the tennis player who just, you know, is out there doing the job and somewhat stone-faced, just keeping emotions in check, but realizing, oh, so people want a little piece of what I'm experiencing, and you can give them that, right? And in my case, a little piece of what's real and not necessarily what I think they need. So yeah, absolutely. So I imagine in that experience then that you, as you mentioned, it helped in many respects inform how you developed as a leader, as a manager.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, all of this is about, I think work is a good word. And I think work has a bad reputation, right? As a word, right? I think that to be human is to constantly have to check in, constantly have to evolve and be resilient as you are evolving. My mom is an executive coach. And so a lot of the transformation that I've gone through over the past few decades now as a working professional have really been because she's helped sort of illuminate and elucidate, here are the tools, here are the things you can do. It's an action. It's not just a, here's who I am, oh well, right? And so also now as a coach myself, you know, the understanding, like, how do you help people both feel comfortable and confident to know that who we are at any given moment is up for debate, up for challenge, up for change. And I think this idea of mindfulness, of just being willing to go to that place is a great start, and it can take you really far.
Yeah. So two things occurred to me. One, and I think it came out of perhaps the previous story, but one of the things you mentioned was relating to, in essence, not what you resist persists. That's sort of my take on that. So being curious and being willing to take chances and realizing that your first efforts may not turn out exactly as you wanted, but being willing to take those chances with the willingness to learn from the experience. And I think you told me a story about your niece and Sesame Street, and I'd love you if you could kind of bring that back for me.
Sure. So I have two nieces, one just turned 3 and the other just turned 5. But the 3-year-old, I guess maybe a year, or even 2 now, you know, Elmo, Sesame Street is popular in our family, has been since I was a kid. And Elmo has this prompt, and I hope I get it right. People can tell me if I don't. But I think it goes, I wonder, what if, let's try. And I find that incredibly powerful. You know, this idea of giving yourself that permission to think, huh, okay. And then to tweak and say, well, what if? And then let's try. And this idea of trying, right? This idea of growth mindset and of, I'm not good at something yet, right? Like this possibility of, it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't ever have to be perfect. But this idea of, like, if you don't try, if you're not curious, all of these things, right? Like for me, I don't know how one gets through life without some of those things, but I know that being able to name them is also important. So I'm kind of grateful to my niece and Elmo by proxy, right? In terms of, like, that's a framework that I can work with.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I'm a huge fan of Carol Dweck's work with the growth mindset. And one of the things that in the world, my training world, talking about the growth mindset and realizing that none of us are either fully growth or fully fixed mindset, that it's all contextual. And I'm wondering in your life, if you've been able to kind of determined to say, here's some areas where I know I've got that growth mindset, and here's some areas where it's like, I'm becoming aware that I still have a fixed mindset. Do you have any of that?
Well, you can ask my wife. I probably have many, but I think, I mean, you know, I mentioned my wife, it's kind of a joke, but having a partner who has areas where they are very different from you and also very similar is helpful, I think, in this. The physical world. So right now is growing season, and she is growing peppers and cucumbers and other tomatoes inside our house. She has a whole setup of different grow lights, and there are cords, and there are, you know, coat rat. Like, it's like an engineer's dream nightmare. I'm not sure. And we were working on, I walked in and the power went out in that room. And my first thing was, okay, I'll go check one of the many breaker boxes, and I couldn't figure it out. And for me, that was hugely frustrating because it was like, I think I know where this goes. I think what has to happen. And yet I went to this panic place of I couldn't figure it out. Now the whole room is going to blow up, right? Like these are, so I can go very quickly from problem solver to catastrophizing. And I think what I'm learning over time, she's very good at experimentation, right? And that's like an example, but it's kind of like you keep trying things and realizing like, I do have the tools. I don't know how to figure out electricity, but I do know how to figure out this thing called a circuit, right? And so I think for me, the physical world is a place where I struggle with having this sort of like, the consequences feel big, right? But I think in more of the conceptual abstract thinking world, I'm really like, as you mentioned, I'm a writer. I do not plot my stories. I think you talk about plotters and pantsers. Like I am somebody who's like, let the story take me where I want it to go. Let the characters breathe. That is hugely exciting to me. It's not debilitating. So it's almost like this, where there are physical consequences, I have to work a little harder at feeling comfortable at not being great at something. But when it's, you know, let the imagination run wild, I'm very comfortable with let's keep trying. Let's keep editing. Let's keep iterating.
Yeah. And I think that that ability to notice how we navigate those different worlds is so important, because we can recognize where we're less comfortable and give ourselves some slack, give ourselves some self-compassion, and bring Elmo into the picture and say, well, let's try, right? Yeah, I can appreciate that, because I'm not the handiest person in the world. And there are times when my sweet, loving, long-suffering wife will say, dude, that's why God invented YouTube. Check it out.
That's true. I would not be able to put together anything without YouTube.
Exactly. And so the ability to say, well, I can get past this because there are some resources that can support me. And by the way, even if I don't get it the first time, it's going to be okay. And I may give myself some credit for trying something that there's a great chance I won't succeed the first time. Whew, that's hard. Probably some similar wiring there if we ended up at the same place in college in that place in New Jersey where most people are pretty high achievers. The fear of failure can be pretty strong, but getting over that and getting over ourselves and saying, well, some of the people that we most respect didn't get it right the first time.
Yeah. And, you know, I will say that college was, I loved Princeton for one, well, many reasons, but one of the reasons was I felt like it was a place of inquiry, at least for me and the people with whom I was friendly. It was not a place of competition. And sometimes you just need playmates in the, you know, like I joke, my mom, we call her our general contractor, but she's had like, you know, I don't know, 40-year head start on us in home ownership. And so whenever something goes wrong, I kind of call her up and I'm like, would you call somebody on this, or would you try this yourself? And just sort of, as you said, having that exchange, having those resources, whether they're virtual, real, somewhere in between, I think, you know, not being alone, community, I think we think about mindfulness, or I do, I think of it as a very solitary, you know, meditation, like you're all alone. But I think there's a huge degree of finding that community that can help you pause, help you feel grounded, help you continue to push and be vulnerable is so critical.
Such a fan of that. I think I may have told you I've been doing virtual online classes for 4 years. And what brings people to that and those who stay tend to value just what you said, which is they want to meditate. They want that quiet, but there's a huge uplift in doing it in community. And sometimes though, I would just say, and I love, I think it was Jeff Warren from 10% Happier was talking about sometimes just meditating and thinking about the millions of people who are meditating at that moment. And that can be like, whoa, it's true.
Right. Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's like, I'm not alone. But that sense of connection and the importance of recognizing what helps us connect and what is inhibiting our connection, what are the obstacles, to me is a major part of the mindfulness practice for me and where I keep working. You know, the obstacles that I have in the world, I think about the joy that my wife and I have with friends that she stayed really close in contact with from college, much better than I have. And recently spending some time with one of my dearest friends and going, oh, I can be better. I can be more proactive. And again, not to beat myself up about what I haven't done in the past, but say, okay, so do it. Right. One of the stories that you shared with me earlier was about, and I love this, the rolling chairs.
Okay. Yeah.
To me, that was so cool and just so full of different elements that kind of bring us into those discussions about being present and aware and relationships and communication, et cetera, et cetera. Do you mind sharing that with me?
Sure. So I've been blessed with a few great therapists and, you know, both have been curious about, you know, kind of like what happens in my world once I leave the therapy room. And so one of them invited my wife, Hillary, to come join me for a session. And we were talking, it wasn't a couples counseling session. It was more of like, here's what Ara's dealing with. And Hillary, you get to be sort of a fly on the wall. And it was more interactive than that. And at some point I went into like super fix it mode, right? Like, oh, Hillary, here's what I'm going to tell you what to do. And I remember my therapist saying like, let's take a time out here. Ara, you're in a chair that rolls, right? Like, why don't you just roll yourself over to Hillary? And I'm like, okay, sure. Like, I trust you. So whatever, we'll do this. And she says, no, give her a hug. And I was like, She's like, because she doesn't need your advice right now. She just needs you to acknowledge where she is and to give her a hug. And I remember that. It's so, so simple, right? And yet, for me, I used to derive a great deal of joy and self-worth of like, I can fix anyone's problem, right? And now, you know, with Hillary, with people at work, people who are friends of mine, I'm constantly toggling and trying to think like, and ask, right? I don't always have to mind read, but to say like, what would be helpful to you in this moment? How can I help? That pause of like, instead of rushing in to solve something that might not need solving at the moment, it just might need seeing. And so I kind of, in my head emotionally, I'm like, oh, this is a rolling chair moment. Yeah.
I'm going to mentally keep that phrase, a rolling chair moment. It's so illustrative. And what I'm hearing is that sense of understanding what's needed and also understanding the natural inclination we have as humans of wanting to fulfill our own personal needs first. And that is way forgivable because it's how we're wired to say, okay, so as a fixer, I'm going to make a gross assumption, but as a fixer, there's a sense of, I need certainty here. I need to see a resolution. That's kind of how I'm wired. I want to be able to move on because the uncertainty of someone struggling, I want to make that go away. Mm-hmm. Okay. On the other hand, the ability to take that step back and say, well, maybe my role in helping assuage the situation is to listen and be present. It is really hard for someone who's wired to fix first. And the ability to catch the impulse to do that is a wonderful awareness flag. And I salute that because it's, again, I think this journey that we're on, our ability to notice those moments, the impulse, the stimulus that says, make this right, fix, right? When hug may be what's needed. And maybe, again, as you described yourself, it's not that you're averse to hugs, but it's not the first impulse.
Right.
Right. In fact, I have this image, and correct me if I'm wrong, I have this image of you hugging madly once things have been great, once they've been fixed. Like, yes. after winning that tennis match, come on, give me a hug. But during the tennis match, lay off.
The high fives come. My team, I remember leaving a job and my team got me a shirt and said, hugger, not a hugger. And it was like, check mark, not a hugger. Yeah. And that's, you know, for me, that's the thing. I think that we, one of the things I've been really interested in sort of growing as a professional is this idea of how does introversion and extroversion, how do they show up in different ways? And really, appreciating when I've had managers who are clear extroverts say like, no, more of you. I want more of you. I don't want you to correct yourself, right? Because wherever we are, there we are. And you can get feedback from the time you're in kindergarten to the time, you know, you get your very last review, whether it's, you know, a theater review, a work review, a review from a spouse, right? And a lot of the things about us are pretty consistent over time. And I think what's been really wonderful is the more, how should I say, awareness around different ways of being in the world, ways of having energy, ways of presenting and showing up has also been helpful, right? That idea of like how much baggage, how much stress, how much exhaustion are we carrying just trying to be the people we think we are supposed to be? Mm. All of these things you and I have been talking about are so much harder when you're tired, when your resources are depleted, right? When you're hungry. And so this idea of how do I care for myself in a world that might not always have my well-being top of mind? Like, how do I stay fueled? How do I stay grounded? How do I stay ready to be able to know that, like, this is not my first inclination. I got to do a little work here. But this idea of energy is just so important and one that I'm consistently thinking about.
I've been thinking about that a lot myself as well. And thinking about, and it's interesting because in full disclosure, I do tend to take care of myself. and I beat myself up sometimes because I have done that before checking out what was needed outside. And there's a balance. And that whole sense of doing the things we need to do so that we can show up 100% for those with whom we're working, our colleagues, our clients, you know, people to whom we're giving care, whatever it could be. I think this is a discussion which has risen in the awareness of organizations and our culture. I don't think we're there yet because I think there's been a lot of pushback. I see a lot of pushback about the quote unquote, you know, younger generation. And now it's probably two generations below me. It's like, oh, they're so needy. They went, and I was like, well, I think they're asking great questions. And I think they're making good points about this sense of, is it work-life balance? Is it work-life harmony? And it reminds me of what your mom said to you, right? What was that? What did she say to you?
Yeah. So I'm fortunate to have both a great mom and stepmom, both of whom are very wise and they are constantly both giving me advice, but two pieces and I'll finish with the one you asked me about, but also salient. Well, actually my mom once said to me, don't define yourself by what you do or where you went to school. Like those things are not the core of who you are, right? And so that's sort of this first part of this conversation. How has it been easy for me to kind of like move through all of these things? At a certain point, I'm Ara. I'm not Ara the Princetonian. I'm not Ara the chief people officer. I'm just Ara who happens to do these things or have these affiliations. And my stepmom once said to me, she said, it came up because I think work-life balance is one of those, you know, obviously terms like during lean-in times. And she said, Ara, I remember a conversation you and I had when you were little. And she's very good at remembering me when I was little. So I'm like, tell me more about this little Ara. And she said, you were very clear that what I did on weekends was I worked and I cleaned. And that took away time that I was able to spend with you. And she said, you know, you were right. And on one level, I did clean a lot and there were things I could delegate. So I was able to have other people clean on our behalf. And yet I loved working. And so I wasn't going to necessarily stop that. And she said, you know, what I thought about was forget work-life balance, try happiness. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I mean, I'm always constantly sort of replaying that because I think this idea of constantly staying in balance, like, you know, there are lots of exercises. Our cores get really strong, right? We're constantly trying to like brace and stay in balance. And to me, this idea of you can be well lopsided, you can love working, right? Like it doesn't mean it's 5 o'clock, quit working just because it's 5 o'clock. It may mean it's 5 o'clock, I want to go make dinner, I have a game I want to see. Those are all choices. And to me, the idea of the freedom of making the choice in whatever way, I think I had a coach who called it a portfolio life. Like, however you want your life portfolio to look, go toward that, not toward these artificial constraints of like, what are the sort of markers of, you know, being in balance, unless that makes you happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And being able to spend the time as needed to really sense what is providing that happiness, because often we just push through and we have these moments of joy and contentment. And for me personally, I've had to be more intentional about, wait a minute, I just felt good. What was it that made me feel good? Because I need more of that. And it's not like I need all of that. I think the sense of having a life that's 100% blissful, it isn't going to happen.
Right.
But understanding that the more one becomes attuned to what's providing fulfillment and contentment and happiness and joy and saying, and by the way, appreciate it when it's there, savoring it. Because that's another thing I think culturally we just, that was great. And we moved on. And I'm reminded about the books I've read or listened to, TV shows and movies that I've watched, music that I've heard that has been most impactful, I've experienced, and then I've talked about. And we know from neuroscience that those neural pathways become so important because they allow us to retrieve that experience. But we often just are so busy, and it gets back again. So you talked about doing and then being defined by where you went to school and what you do, as opposed to who you are. And one of the joys for me in the time, these moments that you and I have had to have spent together, is I'm getting a better and better picture of who Era is. And one of the things that I most enjoy about having gone back to kind of rediscover that is how you found storytelling. And you've done a great job in our time together, but I want to know a little bit more. So how did that sort of arise in sort of your personal awareness? And then you became very intentional that was going to be the core of sort of how you lived your life.
Yeah, I think, you know, early on, one of my earliest memories of school is book publishing day. We used to get to bind. So there were these cardboard covers, wallpaper, you know, that would be, you could go pick your cover from the library. And then you had a story, you had to kind of write out the story and you would give it to your teacher and somebody would type it out on a typewriter. And then you get to illustrate your story and then you would have a published book. And, you know, that was first grade. And I mean, for me, this idea of I can tell a story, because my dad, you know, my dad went to Cooper Union for graphic design and he's always been a great creative playmate for me. From a little kid, he would, you know, use my dolls to have voices and we'd read stories together. So this idea of like telling stories, making things up has always been sort of part of it. But as I got older, you know, I got to college and I said, I'm going to be an art history and visual arts major. And part of that is going to be, I'm going to make documentary films. I'm going to sort of I'm going to try to understand myself through stories about others. I'm going to think about what does it mean to be upwardly mobile and African American in Northern New Jersey. I'm going to look at what does it mean to come out to one's family and friends. And I remember my teachers always saying, like, but where are you in this? Where are you? Get in there. Mm. And it was, I think, you know, it's hard sometimes because as you're writing your story, it's hard to know what it actually is. But I think for me, this idea of having discipline around what does it mean to construct a story that, I think my wife actually just mentioned, something so specific to you that can still be universal. And that is the challenge of both being so inwardly focused about what motivates me to tell a story, but then to realize there is an audience that I would love to have, and trying to think, how is this story in service of whatever that audience is? And so, as we've mentioned, I do work, and I'm not a full-time author. And so there have been times when I've had to say, like, what does this vacation look like to me? Is it going to a writer's conference? When Hillary and I are on vacation, she's often painting outside and I'm tapping away on my phone. This idea of these two novels, people said, well, how did that happen? Like, where did you find time to do that? You know, we've been pretty intentional about how we order our lives. There are consequences. You know, we've said we don't have children. Part of that is because we want to have the time and the space to pour things into the world that are not our children. Mm-hmm. Some of it is we sort of live pretty simple lives where a lot of it is like devoted to creativity. Some of it is acknowledging the structures, right? Like, I spent a great deal of my 20s querying literary agents, trying to say, hey, I've got this story. And, you know, realizing that it was really hard for them to figure out, like, how can I put you into this saleable box? And I don't fault them, right? I was a sales director for WPRB. I get what it means to have a commercial product that you can sell. And yet having to make that choice of saying, you know what, the world has really moved past like the big five publishers. You can actually get your story out there without that. And pushing myself to kind of get over the, well, what does that mean to self-publish? It means that you are telling a story and your story can now be out there for others to find. And so I think, you know, just there's one about being intentional about creating the space that allows you to create. It can be in odd places, right? Like, How to Raise an Art Star was truly written on my subway commute from Brooklyn to Midtown when I was working at Morgan Stanley, like on my phone, vignette style. And some things are going to require you to kind of rethink, what does it mean to be a storyteller in this world? And again, it's not about capital A author, right? It's about lowercase s. I've got a story to tell.
Hmm. Yeah. And I just think that there's so much power in each of our abilities to see the story, to tell it, and to have some input on how the story unfolds when it's a personal, you know, a personal journey. Before we close, I want to get back to something that you and I had talked about before that I kind of glossed over, but it was really, to me, it was really cool. You told me about walking outside and sometimes taking pictures of flowers or whatever. And I just loved that sense of you're being very in that moment and then sharing that moment without necessarily having to add dialogue around it. Would you mind?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I like to be in motion. I like to feel like I'm moving. And I think during the pandemic, I got really good at walking because there wasn't much else we could do. And there are things that when you're walking during a pandemic, before you're vaccinated, before you really know what the world is, that are, I think for me, just remain core. I just remember seeing somebody after being sort of locked down in our apartment in Brooklyn and sort of passing in Prospect Park and just seeing somebody smile again, like without a mask on, and that idea of, ooh, you know, that cringe of like, is this safe? Is this okay? And just having to like retrain oneself to feel like it is safe to be in space with others. But I think what that also taught me was there are so many things that we get to notice in our daily lives. My wife and I actually play a game. It's like we give each other points when we notice strange things. But my mom, among many other things, she's a master gardener. And so there are lots of shows going on our property where the azaleas will bloom, but it's not, it's like the white ones will go and then the pink ones and then the red ones. And then it's like, oh, the mushrooms are here. And then like, you can get kind of like really specific once you realize that, you know, it's not like you wake up and it's all just spring. It's like the Japanese maple is bushy. The cherry tree is pink and then it's green. And so I guess I've been getting even more focused. I don't know if this is true for you, but I've been realizing that my teens and my 20s were very inward, like very era me focused. I think maybe some of that is evolutionarily necessary. But as I'm getting older, I feel very much focused on like, what are the things outside of this body? And how can I capture them? How can I share them? As my parents are aging, I think I'm feeling more urgency around how do we continue to have these moments together? And as you said, I don't really need to say much. I just sort of send the picture and my mom, that's amazing. And It's just like when you're a little kid and you come in from the outside and you're like, I found this twig and it's a pencil, or, you know, like I made a fort. It's like a pile of, yeah, but like returning back to that wonderment about all the things that nature just provides, if you're just willing to pause and notice them.
The wonderment.
Yeah.
And by the way, I celebrate your sort of understanding the internal versus external awareness. I celebrate yours doing a little more quickly than I did, but it's okay.
We're all on our own time frame.
Exactly. As I've told many people, my wife laughs about my mindfulness journey, beginning to meditate about 20 years ago. And, you know, she said, look, he is not enlightened, but he's a lot less of a jerk than he used to be.
That's the goal. Just be less of a jerk than one was when we started.
And that's part of the journey. To me, it's like, you know, each day is just being a little less of a jerk, but I have so enjoyed our time together, and I've learned so much, not only about Ara Tucker, but just about the whole journey, the whole sense of how mindfulness lives in reality and in real time. As much as I love the time that I spend on the cushion, so to speak, you've so demonstrated that these things can be nurtured with intention if it's something that's important to you. And I think that may be our strongest lesson is it important to you? It probably should be, right? And maybe that's what we can do to weave into our story. I'm going to suggest that people should look for a couple of books. Can they find them on Amazon?
They can find them on Amazon. Yes, they can.
Yep. So How to Date a Black Girl and How to Raise an Art Star. Yep. And they're novels, correct?
They're novels. Yes, they're novels. How to Raise an Art Star is also available on Audible. And they are both available on Kindle. So hardcover or paperback, audio, or, you know, electronic, however one wants to receive the story. It's there for you. Happy to do readings.
I think that's exciting. And I also think your willingness to admit that these are things that you started working on years ago gives me great hope, because among other things I share with you, this podcast has been probably 6 or 7 years in the making. Everything in its time. Ara, thank you so much. Bless you. And I look forward to perhaps running into you at Old Nassau in the not too distant future.
Sounds great, Clayton. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening. I want to take a moment to thank my producer, Marianne Sanders, as well as my friends at Meditation for Leadership in helping launch this podcast. Until next time,
This is Clayton Platt, encouraging you to look for those moments of magic in your life where mindfulness plays out in real time.